everybody. Thanks for joining us on Code Chat. This is a special episode of Code Chat because this is my first time recording in my new studio. And I'm joined today by Jason Dobry. How you doing?
Good.
Good. Did I pronounce your last name right?
It's Dobry.
Dobry. There yes. You go. All right. I like to have that correct. So the idea here is that this is a studio that's in my backyard, so I can do things like this very close to home and very easily. I call it CodeWork Studio, and there it is. I think you'll be seeing a lot more of the wood wall behind my recordings. So
it's coming together. I like it.
Thank you. Today's episode is about JS Data, a library that Jason has created and is maintaining and working on. And it's a really exciting topic. I actually heard about this at a code camp recently. Somebody else was talking about it and just raving about how awesome this library is. You got to try it. So looked into it, looked Jason up. Hey, it turns out he's in my same town. So we can have a nice little chat here. This is excellent. So Jason, why don't you tell us what JS Data is and how it was birthed?
Sure. So I would say maybe 2.5 years ago now, I was building a very large Angular app. And so, you know, it was probably one of those...
Did you mean Ember?
It was actually Angular.
It was Angular.
It was
okay.
Angular. And so it was one of those typical, like, CRUD apps, you know? It just has a bunch of models, and you're doing typical, like, sort of database operations on them, making new records, deleting records, modifying records. So
okay. There's
a lot of boilerplate code
right.
involved. And so for Angular, you know, there was Restangular, and that was it.
I mean, that was it.
Angular itself doesn't really ship with a really nice sort of model layer.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of leaves that up to you. I guess there was ng resource, but it was a very, very light wrapper around plain HTTP calls. And we wanted some more advanced functionality, like caching whole queries and doing filtering on in-memory collections. And then we even implemented a sort of three-way binding, kind of like what Firebase advertised,
okay.
where we had when events happened on a backend, they could notify our clients through PubSub
yeah.
or sockets
right.
or something like
sure.
that. And then the browser would pull that new record and then insert it into the collection in this sort of data model that we put together, and then have it updated automatically in the view. And so if you had multiple browsers open on the same page, it was like that Firebase magic effect.
Yeah, yeah.
But we did it not with Firebase, using a data layer originally called Angular Data.
Okay.
And then it has since evolved to JS Data.
Okay. And so JS Data is, in looking at it, it kind of has that that same feel, not because it's necessarily the real-time data feel, you know, the like things updating live, but because it feels to me like the right API, you know, like it feels like things done right.
Yeah. So I tried to find conventions that, satisfy the majority of use cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of looked around for various REST patterns that people had advertised, lots of blog posts, and tried to find something that was like, there's that game you can get on your phone called 94%.
Yeah.
Where like, when you think of an image, like 94% of people think of these things. And so I'm trying to think of JS Data in the same way, where 94% of CRUD use cases, it can just meet those.
Do that, yeah.
If not out of the box, then with some slight tweaking based on like the configurability that JS Data provides. And then for that remaining 6% where you need some sort of extreme performance or really sort of quirky queries,
yeah.
you can do that yourself.
Right? Okay, so is, just for positioning, for people understanding like what JS Data is and where it fits, is this an ORM?
Yes.
Okay, it is definitely an ORM. ORMs, in my experience, are excellent because one of the reasons why they're excellent is because they allow you to connect to multiple providers.
Yes.
So is that the case with JS Data?
Yes. Usually an ORM is actually written for a single provider. And then if it incorporates the adapter pattern, then yes, it can
okay.
work with multiple providers. Originally, Angular Data itself, it was only a browser library, and it only worked over HTTP.
Okay.
It just made REST calls. And
yeah.
then over time, the idea came like, why can't this work on the server? And then I added the adapter pattern, and it works in the browser, on the server, and MySQL, MongoDB, RethinkDB, Firebase, REST calls, local storage, Redis.
Whatever.
So whatever we can write an adapter for, it'll do CRUD operations against that data store.
Okay. So what would you say are the biggest strengths or differentiators of the library?
So it's going to save you a ton of boilerplate code.
Okay.
Especially as you get into the dozens or hundreds of models. Like if you have one of those massive CRM-like apps that either you're building for clients or in like an internal enterprise app, mm-hmm. There's a ton of boilerplate because CRUD operations are the same for yep. regardless of what model. So there's a ton of boilerplate. And then it uses pretty typical conventions as far as the nomenclature of its method calls. So it's pretty easy to grok or to get started with.
Yeah,
you're just
right.
like, I want to find something. Okay, I find it. If I want to create something, I want to create it. And then it uses that sort of convention to be easy to understand. Right now it's becoming a lot more flexible so that you can incorporate maybe plugins to give you better flexibility in what frameworks you're using with it, whether it be various Vue frameworks, like if you want to use React or Vue or even Meteor or something like that. And then on the server, being able to plug it into whatever you're using on the server.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty versatile. Now, in my experience also, one of the other big advantages of an ORM is the really convenient navigation API, the ability to navigate from one entity to another based on their relationships. And I would imagine that JS Data allows
yes,
that as well.
Yes, it supports relations. You basically just provide that little meta information to the library so that it understands how your entities are linked. And then, for example, the in-memory store, as you're loading records from your database into the application, it can automatically just start attaching them to each other.
And okay.
You could basically just navigate with the dot operator as deep or as in circles or whatever you wanted to do.
Wow.
And it will keep the links up to date automatically as you change things.
So if I'm working on a bookstore, I've got my bookstore and I can dot books and then I can find the book, a book with a certain ISBN number, and then I can just dot author, dot first name, and I can just kind of continue to navigate through my whole web, my whole graph of data.
Yeah.
That's pretty thrilling.
You could assign a new author to a book and it'll update that book's foreign key, or you could change the book's foreign key and it'll update the author that's linked to it, vice versa.
You know, whenever the ORMs get rich and semantic enough, it starts to feel like it's doing away with any need for a data access layer at all. Do you find that that's the case? Do you find that this just makes the data access layer very elegant, or do you feel like this kind of makes it unnecessary to have a data access layer?
I almost consider JS Data your data access layer.
Okay.
Yeah. You could even use it for a bunch of sections of your business logic, extend the models to handle for extra queries and methods, and then it just kind of does all the data stuff.
Okay.
It's your data. It helps you respect your data, so to speak.
There you go. Now, I've used Microsoft's Entity Framework quite a lot as an ORM, and I know with Entity Framework, I have the ability to create maps between my tables that are actually in my persisted data and the actual objects in memory. Is that the case with JS Data as well? Can you map the field names and so on?
Yeah, you could do that.
Okay.
It's one of those things that I'm trying to flush out a little more in the current beta for V3, as far as like maybe changing and morphing field names. But yeah, as an ORM, its main object or purpose is to take records and map them to in-memory objects.
Yeah, right.
And stuff like, and vice versa, saving them.
Yeah, right. Well. Yeah, good. Yeah, and then maybe obscuring some of the fields, you know, like the fields that don't belong in consumption that you're not supposed to use as a developer. They just kind of belong in the data.
Yeah, and one of the newer features is I'm trying to make a schema, working with a schema a little more native in JS Data so that you could maybe attach various temporary view attributes to your objects, but then based on your schema, you can get the official database subset of those fields and then kind of pull that out and enforce that strictness, so to speak.
Yeah. Where are most people, like are most people using this through a Node project or through a front end project? Or do you have any visibility into how people are using JS Data so far?
A lot of them in the browser.
Okay.
Using it to connect to their RESTful backend.
Okay.
Probably because that was its primary, that's what it was originally built for. and I haven't really advertised the server-side stuff as much.
Yeah.
It really shines if you are using Node on the back end, because you can use JS Data in the browser and on the back end.
Yeah, wow.
And it's sort of that universal JavaScript feel.
Yeah, right.
So your model definitions, where you've defined your relations or your schemas, you can actually share that code between the front end and the back end.
Perfect.
And then since it's JS Data on both sides, they understand each other natively. So you could be formulating queries right in your browser JavaScript and have those that data pulled all the way out of the database for you by JS Data all the way up to the browser.
That's where it gets exciting. Now I can have JavaScript on the server and the client, and I can have a robot over here. And they're all running JavaScript, right?
Right.
All sharing the right kind of data. Well, let's take a look at it.
Sure.
So we're looking here at your website. And this, we've already gotten a bit of an overview, but let's just kind of dive into some of the examples and see what we can look at. Do I assume I click on examples here?
Go ahead.
All right.
So there's, I guess, the first one says it's an introduction to JS Data.
Okay. All right, this is going to open in Plunker, so we're going to actually be able to play with it. Tell me what's going on with this one.
So it looks like it's using V1 of JS Data.
Okay, is that an old one? What are we up to now?
It's on V2
okay.
right now. But there weren't really huge breaking changes between V1 and V2.
Okay.
So it's probably pretty similar.
Okay.
I've been working on V3 so much, I forgot to upgrade this one to V2. But yeah, so this is a Plunker, and I've separated out into multiple JavaScript files. It looks like each one is demonstrating various CRUD operations.
Okay.
I pulled in Firebase and the Firebase adapter.
All right. Help me find the Firebase adapter. Is that here under Register Firebase?
So it's being pulled in from the CDN.
Oh, I see. Okay.
CDN.js.
Okay, so we've got Firebase. Let me see if I can get my font a little bit larger for people here. So the first script reference here is what?
Firebase.
That's Firebase itself.
Yep.
And then the adapter is JS Data Firebase.
JS Data Firebase.
Okay, wonderful.
What the adapters do is there's an interface defined. Like, what are the CRUD operations that JS Data can do?
Mm-hmm.
Each adapter needs to implement that common interface.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Firebase adapter just translates those CRUD operations that JS Data expects to pulling data out of Firebase and saving it to Firebase.
Okay.
And things like that. So,
does it still facilitate Firebase's ability to do real-time messaging and stuff?
So each adapter under the hood is using some client to speak to whatever persistence layer.
Yeah.
So with that adapter, you could take the client that it's using to talk to Firebase, and you can do that for your views to get real-time stuff. It basically, the adapter turns Firebase into a CRUD-like data store.
Oh, I see.
Obviously, one of the main reasons to even use Firebase is so you can get that real-time syncing.
Sure.
And so
yeah.
Matt, your friend who introduced me to you, he has taken over management of the JS Data Firebase adapter.
Excellent.
And he is going to add first-class support for that three-way sync from JS Data to Firebase and vice versa. He's working
on
that.
Very cool. Sounds like a big job.
Yeah.
Okay, now we're bringing in a few other libraries here. Store, Register Firebase, and what are these all?
So let's look at store.js first.
Okay, we'll go over here.
And it's one line of code.
That's great.
So because we pulled in JS Data through a script tag, it put a global, it put a variable onto the global namespace called JS Data.
There we go.
And so here we just initialize a store. DS is a constructor function. And we just new up a new store.
All right. And are the other ones as simple? Or no, they've got a little bit more weight to them, right?
Each one is demonstrating various CRUD operations.
Okay.
So I think the next one that gets pulled in actually is maybe user.js.
Okay.
So here we take that reference to the store that we created and we call define resource.
Okay.
And what that's doing is it's saying, hey, JS Data, I want to give you some meta information about one of my models.
Okay.
It's called user. And that's the only configuration we give it is a name. And based on the name user, JS Data makes a ton of inferences about what it can do with users. And for example, if we were using the HTTP adapter, it would be able to do posts and puts and gets on various endpoints to do all those various CRUD things for users.
Okay.
If we wanted, there are 20 more options that we could set here to tweak and configure and massage JS Data into whatever system that we have been using previously.
I see.
If you're trying to bring JS Data into an existing system, then you're probably going to have to do that.
Right.
If you're building a new app from scratch, you can just use the conventions and then it's that simple.
Yeah, right. Okay, and then which one's next? We started at index, and so there was user, and now we've got inject users, right? Should I go there?
We missed one. Register okay. Firebase. All right. So go to that one. So all that does is it instantiates the Firebase adapter.
Okay.
We got to configure it with our Firebase endpoint, so it knows where to, what to talk to.
Okay. And does then, Firebase require that we have some sort of an application key to authenticate ourselves?
Nope.
Oh, well.
Well, by default, Firebase is wide open.
Okay, and then you can...
Anyone could write to your Firebase.
There you
so
go.
Usually you would put some sort of access control list rules okay. into your Firebase, and so in which case you would probably need to authenticate as a user to gain access to write your own data and things like that.
Okay.
Here we use a wide open database or Firebase for simplicity in this plunker.
Okay.
And then, so we instantiate the adapter and then we register it with the store under a name. You could actually register multiple adapters with the store.
Hmm.
And
so now you can talk to Firebase here and MySQL over here.
If you have multiple data sources, you could use JS Data to talk to all of them with the same API.
Okay, so then in my code, I'm talking to my store, and it might be talking to two databases.
You don't even need to know what your data source
sure.
is. You just
yeah.
use the interface that JS Data provides.
This is a bit of an aside, but I had this question came to mind. A really common scenario in things like mobile and maybe even on websites is the ability to handle offline data. Does JS Data give
so
me any facility?
There's a local storage adapter.
Okay.
There's also a local forage adapter if you
okay.
wanted to take advantage of like IndexedDB. So you could load the HTTP adapter and the local storage adapter, and as you pull in data to your store, you can save it to local storage.
Oh, interesting.
And there's a what's called strategies so that when you're trying to read data, you can have it try a second adapter if it can't find the data in the first adapter.
Oh, interesting.
And so you can do things like that. You could try local storage first. If it's not there, pull from HTTP. Or, for example, on the server, try Redis first, and if it's not in Redis, try MySQL.
Okay.
And you like have like a free caching layer, so
yeah,
to speak.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, that makes it really powerful. I mean, then JS Data is kind of in the middle and allows me to use the same code to talk to multiple bases.
A unified API
yeah.
on the browser, on the server, cross persistence layer,
yeah.
whatever.
Excellent. Okay, what's next? I'm going to jump back to index.html and see. After register Firebase and user, now we inject the users?
Let's look at that.
Okay.
So what this is doing is it's creating just some in-memory data. We still haven't even done anything with the adapter.
Okay.
So create instance basically just creates a new record
yeah.
in memory, and we gave it a few fields. Injecting it takes that record and puts it into the store.
Okay.
And then the store kind of keeps track of that record. The store itself is what's called an identity map. So if you were to inject multiple records that all have the same primary key into the store, they will all actually be merged together into one record.
Okay.
So that user that we inject into the store, as long as that user's in the store, any reference to that user is still valid.
All right.
So it's kind of the total opposite of like what immutable JS does,
okay.
where it uses different references to actually signify changes between objects. Whereas with an identity map, you have one copy of any record at any given time.
Hmm. Okay, I gotcha.
So you can modify it, and your reference to it just stays valid. You don't lose your reference to the object.
So it's almost like a singleton per ID.
Per primary key, per model
key,
type,
yeah. okay.
it's a singleton record in memory.
Okay.
And here we're just demonstrating a few methods where you can retrieve a record from the store based on its primary key.
Okay.
You can check whether a particular record has changes, whether it's changed since it was injected, and you can even get an object describing what those changes are.
Okay.
So JS Data V2 actually uses Observe.js,
okay.
which unfortunately has gone away.
Going away.
It's going away. So I had to totally refactor that for V3. But in V2, it uses Observe.js, so all of the in-memory records, you can just track all the changes that are happening to them.
Live.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's probably more useful in the browser, but there's that thing.
Okay, excellent. All right, now what's next?
Create.
Now we create, update, and destroy. Let's go to create.
So here we're actually going to communicate with one of the adapters. So what we do is we call the create method on the user resource that we previously defined. We pass in some properties, and then the store delegates to whatever adapter is configured. And we told the store to use the Firebase adapter by default, so it will.
Yeah.
And then it's an asynchronous operation. So it returns a promise, and then when the promise resolves, we are given the created record.
And we didn't have to worry about the ID. It handled that for us.
Yep.
And is it, I see that we've got a an ID that's more than just a serial number here. Is that right?
Yeah, so this is something generated by Firebase.
Okay. Oh, I see. I see. Before we said one, and now we've got...
Yeah, so actually, at this point in time, there are two users in the store.
Yeah.
One we created manually in memory and just put it into the store. That user doesn't correspond to any record in any database anywhere.
It's just like...
It's like temporary in memory, has a primary key of one. The second user that has now been injected into the store was actually saved to Firebase, and then once it was saved to Firebase, Firebase gave us the user, and we put it into the in-memory store.
So how does the one that we did manually and gave the ID of one, how does it get into the store?
So the first one, we just put it into the store ourselves with the inject method.
Oh, okay. We did use inject. Did it get, is Firebase able to say, okay, well, you've got an ID of one, whereas you've got an ID of IJDKU?
So that first user doesn't exist in Firebase.
Ever.
At all.
What if
we haven't saved it?
Okay.
It's just sitting in the store unsaved, so to speak.
Okay. And injecting doesn't put it into Firebase. No. It just puts it into the store.
So how
do I get that guy into Firebase?
So you could either get a reference to that user and call it save method, and it'll save itself to Firebase. Or we could use that same create method that we just used.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So there are two users in the store. After this second user was created, it was injected into the store for us automatically. And then right here on line 12, we're saying retrieve the user out of the store that has this ID.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see that it's strictly equal, which means it's the same reference to the same object.
Okay.
Right? So this user that Firebase gave us is in the store. So anytime you call .get on that same primary key, you're going to get back the same reference to the same object.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's sort of that identity map thing coming into play.
Okay. Okay, and then we return that user.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So that's the create. And the create is actually returning, is it actually returning a promise? Oh, at the top level here, we have a promise being created, right? Of our promise?
The reason I created saved the promise to a variable is so that I could reuse it in these other files.
Okay.
To sort of enforce that serial, set of operations.
Okay.
Because I didn't want the update to happen, have any sort of race condition.
Yeah.
It's just a quirk of the demo.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, now we destroy?
Update was the next one. So this is just saying, okay, that user that we previously created, it does not have any changes. Because it was just brand new created, injected into the store, we haven't changed anything. And here what I do is I say user.role is equal to admin, observe.js picks that up, and then it says, next time we call has changes, it says, yes, this user has changes.
Mm-hmm.
And we can even inspect those changes if we were to call, say, user.changes. If you want to, we could even try that to see what the object looks like. So maybe right under has changes, do user.changes and pass in user.id, maybe console.log that whole line.
All right.
And then you'll want to open up your developer tools so we can see the console.
Oops, I already hit run before I got to my console. There we go.
Did it run? It's working on it.
All right.
There it is. So it's the second line is the changes that you logged. And it looks like it has added, changed, and removed. So it should have added. Added, role, admin.
Okay.
And so these change records are sort of produced, and they can even be saved to a history.
Oh,
and
wow.
If you wanted to, you could see the history of changes that had happened to your in-memory records.
You could even use it to recreate a...
Or go back in time something like that.
Yeah.
And then if you were to, completely save the record again, you could... sort of commit the in-memory changes to sort of reset that history.
Okay. Now, in the ORMs I've seen in the past, there's a method called save changes on the data store that saves it back to the database.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the case here? Is there
some
kind of record?
Yep. So the user record itself is a smart record.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the active record pattern, right? Where your individual record instances are decorated with smart behavior so that they can save themselves. right? And then there's another pattern called the data mapper pattern, where maybe your records are dumb, they're just pojos, and you have a sort of greater entity that has the logic for saving
them. Yeah, right.
JS data has both patterns.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so like the capital user, that's your data mapper pattern, where you have this sort of larger entity, like a sort of just like a service that you're using.
Sure.
And then if you like, you're calling, if you could actually grab that lowercase user, the record itself, and you could call dot save, like you were saying, and you could pass it an option like changes only.
Now the uppercase user you said is kind of like a service. It's responsible for handling all of the users, but is it only responsible for handling all the users? So just my users. Business logic for when to save users and how to, you know, what logic to run whenever they're updated and so on exists in user, but I have a different system to manage the other entities in my system.
Yeah, so I would say I wouldn't put any sort of like view logic on this user service, right? That doesn't really belong there. But if you wanted to, like, for example, one thing I do in a very common way is like I want to retrieve the logged in user, right? And so that might be a method that I stick onto this user service because it's just so related to users,
right?
And it's not something JS data, like, it doesn't know exactly what how you're doing logged in users. So you just add that method yourself and sort of attach that little piece of logic to your user. And then if you wanted some, like, let's say there's a method like retrieve all active admins, right? You could do that with the JS data query, formulating some query object, or you could write a method that does that query and attach it to this service. And
gotcha.
Sort of just extend it to do your user logic.
It's good having some flexibility.
Yeah.
And here is where we're doing that save, right?
Yeah, so you could actually do this save in two ways. You could say user.save, and then we're just passing an ID.
Okay.
And it finds that record, and it saves it.
Okay.
You could even just, instead of, you could just do lowercase user.save and don't pass anything, and the record will save itself. So
okay.
There's that, there's the data mapper pattern and the active record pattern. Either way, some people really prefer the active record pattern. So they're going to use the individual record instance as much as possible for updating and saving.
What sort of logic does an active record use to determine that it's time to save itself? Like whenever it gets a new role, it would say, okay, I just got a new role, so I need to save myself?
I don't know if they're not that smart.
Okay.
Like, so you tell it when to save itself.
Okay.
But by virtue of being an active record, it can save itself.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Active records have the capability of saving.
Yeah.
Okay. And this console log of the user obviously happens afterwards because we're using a then, and here it is here, and we can see Sally with a role of admin.
And if we had the Firebase the Firebase console open, we could see that this data was indeed in Firebase.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Okay, there's one more. Destroy.
So, I mean, we've just been demonstrating some of the CRUD operations, creating, updating. Reading. We didn't do a find, but...
So you're saying at some point it gets more complicated than this?
Usually there are some things you do that are a little more complicated than just CRUD. But
there you go.
The kind of the point of it is that this stuff is kind of boring. Doing create, update, read, delete.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I don't want to have to write the boilerplate for that
every
for 100 models,
time.
For every project, for every new framework that I want to write.
It's ridiculous.
It'd be nice if there was just one framework that I could just carry with me from project to project, or from React to Angular, or from Angular to Vue, or whatever view layer I'm switching between because, you know, there's the new hotness that's coming out. It'd be nice if my data layer could just come with me.
Well, it turns out there is.
Yes.
And it can.
Yes.
It's called JS Data.
It's JS Data.
So what does destroy do?
So this is your remove operation, right? The delete sort of CRUD,
okay,
part of CRUD. And so this would remove a record from Firebase. And that's what it does. It takes that user that we created and updated it, and then it then deletes it from
now,
Firebase.
Does the active record pattern translate to destruction as well? Are users allowed to commit suicide?
Yep.
All right.
So you could take user and have it destroy itself.
All right.
But you'd still have that in-memory object. It just no longer corresponds to anything in Firebase.
Ah, I see.
The data was removed from Firebase.
I see.
So...
okay, cool. And there you have it. Man, that was a good introduction. Nice and easy. And this is what I was talking about when I said it kind of feels like the right way. When you are doing things with promises, when you're doing things with just really semantic and logical constructs, then it starts to get exciting. I guess just because for me as a developer, I've always been very easily confused by convoluted code. And it happens really easily. I go into a code base and people are just, you know, trying to get their work done for the day. They're mm-hmm. just, you know, trying to get the story fulfilled, and they can make it work by incurring a little bit of debt. And it's terrible to look at. It's terrible to pick up. It's terrible to try to write a story in, you know, in this, these awful code bases. And so whenever I see code that's written right, I feel like, good, this is going to be understandable by the next human that comes along. And whenever I get assigned a new story, a new feature in here, or a new bug fix in here, I'm going to be able to make sense of it pretty quickly. That's exciting.
Yeah. JS Data is easy to read.
Yeah.
It reads well. User dot create some properties. I mean, how do you misunderstand
that? I know.
The beauty of that, though, is it's actually doing some pretty complex things. It's mm-hmm. talking to maybe various data sources. It's abstracted away MySQL from your code, and you don't have to know SQL to work with MySQL. So that's kind of the beauty of that.
Yeah. Okay, now we just looked at the really simple example, and that's all we'll cover right now. But I imagine that if I go into the samples, I'm gonna find a number of the more complicated scenarios.
Certainly.
Fleshed out there. That's good. And then you mentioned that we are currently at JS Data 2. That's the one that's in production?
Yeah, 2.8.2, I believe.
Okay.
So I've been working on, like I said, 2.5 years ago, this was sort of born as Angular Data.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the last 2.5 years, I've gone through a V1 of JS Data, which is the more framework agnostic version of Angular Data. And now V2. It's like I'm building a house and just starting out, I didn't really know exactly what I wanted the house to look like. And as each new developer came to the project and started using JS Data with their ideas, I'd patch on a room or a window, and mm-hmm. over time it becomes unwieldy because it wasn't mm-hmm. architected like that from the beginning.
Right, right.
So there are all of these lessons that I have learned, and then V3 is a complete rewrite from scratch. I started with a blank file, and I rewrote JS Data from scratch, and the main purpose was to make it more flexible. We showed the define resource method.
Mm-hmm.
In V2, that's pretty much your only entry point into the architecture of JS Data. You define a resource, and that's the only component that you have to work with.
Hmm.
And that single component has many responsibilities. In JS Data, I've split it into multiple components, and so you can sort of compose them into your data layer as you need it to work.
Okay.
So like the store itself is its own component, or the data mapper part that does the actual CRUD operations, that's its own component, and you can start to combine them. The active record part, that's its own component. So you can start to customize the active record part of it. And then because the components are exposed and they're just functions, just constructor functions,
mm-hmm.
it's really, really easy to make plugins.
Hmm.
So we talked about that Firebase three-way sync. To actually implement that, it would be really hard in V2
mm-hmm.
because V2 simply was not architected that way.
Right.
There's one store and it does everything.
Mm-hmm.
In V3, there's a store component. And what the Firebase adapter can do is it can take the store component and extend it.
Oh, wow.
Use it as like a base class. Okay. And then this extended version could tack on a bunch of Firebase three-way sync things and become like a Firestore, so to speak.
Yeah.
And after V3 ships stable, I intend to investigate, say, like an immutable store, which would be the opposite of the identity map that ships with JS Data by default. Because some people, I mean, it has different trade-offs, different performance trade-offs. With immutable data, you can very quickly tell whether something has changed, but maybe it uses more memory.
Mm-hmm.
And so I intend to create like an immutable store, which would be another component. And in V2, there's no way to do an immutable store.
Yeah, stores are stores.
It's not extendable.
Right.
I mean, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. So V3 is incredibly flexible. Lots of components that you can compose into the data layer you need for your app. So that was the big thing. Lots of lessons learned there. Had to rewrite change detection because Observe.js is going away.
Mm-hmm.
It's now more akin to Backbone's change detection.
Okay.
I also am incorporating schemas more natively into JS Data V3 using the JSON schema.org mm-hmm. spec V4.
Good.
So that spec, I think, is familiar to a lot of people.
Sure.
For example, like, many Google APIs use that spec to describe themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a standard that I wanted to adhere to sort of appeal to more people right away. If they understand that spec, then they know how schemas work in JS Data.
Yeah, right.
And it will do validation too. even as you're setting properties.
That's exciting. Yeah. So there's already good stuff out there, but V3 is bringing a number of big changes down
bringing
the pipe.
Heat.
Are you working on this by yourself, or you got a little team, or?
So I have done the majority of the work myself. I think the easiest part about a project is the code. Next up in difficulty is the documentation. Mm-hmm. As much time as you spend on code, you have to spend more than that on documentation.
Yep.
Documentation is hard because you have to communicate to people in English.
Yeah.
Because they don't know what's in your head. They didn't know what was in my head when I wrote JS Data, and I have to be able to communicate that to people. And then beyond documentation is actually contribution. Pull requests, issues, people have ideas, they want to implement themselves, but maybe they didn't understand your original philosophy on how you wanted the code base structure.
Right.
So it's for me, that's the most difficult part of it. And I've been working with some people that for the last, I have a couple folks that I've been using as sort of whiteboards to help with ideas. And so I actually created a team page, and I got pictures up there of like four or five people that have been pretty involved, Matt, like we mentioned. And there's a huge list of areas of responsibility that need contributors. And I would love it if someone were to find one of those and say, hey, I would love to work on benchmarking tests or something like that. And I'll say, knock yourself out. You're the man, or you're the woman. And there are currently 10 adapters. So we were just talking about JS Data, but then there are 10 adapters. And each adapter is quite a bit
project.
Of work, because whoever owns that adapter needs to know everything about like the data store that it's working with, like SQL or RethinkDB or something like that.
How much do those adapters have to change whenever you roll major versions of JS Data?
I haven't changed the interface at all since I started. I feel like I picked a pretty good adapter interface right from the get-go. And then for V3, I created a base adapter that all of the adapters extend now.
Okay.
So it's almost trivial to write a new adapter.
Good.
This base adapter does all the heavy lifting. It does all of the eager loading for relations and resolving them. But even then, there are more projects, and we have more ideas of things we want to do. Just last week, or the week before, I started a JS Data Express project where you give it your model definitions, and it generates all the RESTful routes for your Express application. And then a friend is maintaining that now.
Excellent.
So it's excellent to have people jump on board to sort of expand the project and grow the organization.
It's funny, too, because if you develop your core product, I keep coming back to this right way. If you develop your core product the right way, then you're going to get these people jumping in and looking at it and saying, this is exciting. This is something I want to be involved in, and I'm willing to take some slice of it and manage it, or I'm willing to do some pull requests. You know, like when you feel like this is code that's going to save me time in my day-to-day job, this is something that I'm going to care about. So you'll get some people jumping in.
And it's incredibly satisfying as the original author when someone is willing to contribute like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's really validating. You know, it's just really you know, this actually is pretty good if someone else likes it.
Yep.
Like, it's just that feel good sort of moment when someone says, yeah, I'd love to work on this.
That's wonderful. Well, Jason, kudos on the project. I'm really excited about it. I wish you the best on success as far as uptake. If you guys are watching, definitely go to js-data.io and try it out. See if this is going to work for your projects. I think chances are it will.
And I'm more than happy to answer questions. I'm on Slack all
the
time, mailing list, Stack Overflow questions.
Do you use Gitter much?
I used Gitter originally, and then switched to Slack.
Slack,
and we have a bunch of different channels for different purposes and
Excellent.
Things like that. And everything that goes into Slack, I have archived with slackarchive.io or I think something.
How
like
do people get a Slack invite?
So if you go to slack.js-data.io, you can invite yourself.
Excellent.
You can just join.
Wonderful.
So
good. All right. Well, is anything else you want to add for developers?
I would just say V3 beta is stable. I don't expect any breaking changes.
Cool.
Maybe some new features are going to get added before it goes stable. And then really the big thing is documentation. I probably quadrupled the amount of documentation for V3.
Cool.
Going into this release. JS docs throughout all of the source, and then generating API docs from that, which would be very They're very thorough.
Yeah, right.
It just gives you that API surface that you can look at for all the various projects. But I need help with documentation and just sort of feedback. So if anyone wants to, even if it's just fixing a typo, or if someone actually wants to say, hey, there's something I figured out to do with JS Data in mm-hmm. my app, and mm-hmm. I want to share that. So maybe I'll write a little blog post, or maybe I want to contribute to like a little small tutorial to the main website, I'd be more than happy to accept it.
Excellent. Wonderful. Okay, we're going to wrap it up there. Thanks for joining me, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you guys for joining us on another episode of Code Chat, and we'll see you next time.